Welcome to the Gay Buddhist Forum, where teachers from all schools of Buddhism offer their perspectives on the Dharma and its application in modern times, especially for LGBTQI audiences. These talks are offered freely to the world and made possible by appreciative listeners. If you would like to support our efforts to share the Dharma with underserved audiences, please visit gaybuddhist.org. There you can donate, find a list of upcoming speakers, or enjoy many hundreds of these recorded talks dating back to 1996.
It's my privilege to introduce David Lewis, who's a longtime member of this sangha. And David has been following the Dharma path for 45 years. He has a degree in comparative religious studies and is a graduate of Spirit Rock Meditation Center's Dedicated Practitioners Program. He teaches insight meditation and enjoys sharing the Dharma at several sanghas around the Bay Area. He is a proud, longtime member of GBF.
Oh, it makes me so happy to be here, to be back. Seems like forever, but I think I was going to be here a year ago. I don't know, Jeff, do you remember?
It's been something like that, yeah.
It's kind of a codicil to my bio. I'm turning 70 this year. Which is, I know, not that old, and I know there's people in this room older than me, but when you've been living with AIDS for 35 years, 70 feels more like 80. So I'm very grateful to be here. My eyesight's about 50%, my hearing's about 50%, and one of the reasons I'm telling you this is because I have some cognitive deficit. Like, for instance, I came in this morning and saw somebody I've known for years across the room, and I knew what their name was, and by the time I got up to say hello to them, I didn't know what their name was. And that can happen to me in the middle of a talk. In fact, it actually does. So I've kind of been cheating these Zoom years of the pandemic, because I can cover half my screen giving a talk. Nobody knows, but I need help. So I read more than I used to. But the other reason I'm telling you that is I'm honestly, at 70, I'm as happy as I've ever been in my life and content. And life is just good at this age, despite all my complaints. And that's because of my practice. I have no doubt that that's because of my mindfulness practice. That no matter what's going on, I can be in the moment. And in the moment, there's nothing wrong. So, you almost got to talk today about the heavenly messengers, because that's what's been on my mind, is old age, illness, and death. But it occurred to me that you really need to ask permission to give a talk about the heavenly messengers. They can be triggering for some people. So if you'd really like to have a talk about old age, illness, and death, and its relation to the Dharma, tell me. Yeah, tell somebody. Yeah. Somebody share it. Yes. And if you think that's only a talk for old men like me, it's just a reminder that Buddha had that insight at the age of 29, and it changed the rest of his life. It's what put him on the path. It was the heavenly messenger story. So maybe another time we'll get that. The other person that's really great on that topic is Eugene Cash, who I know everybody enjoys here. So this morning I wanted to talk about simplicity, the simplicity of practice, which is the other thing that's been on my mind. Because the longer I practice, my other anniversary this year, more or less anniversary, is I've been practicing for about 50 years. which sounds more impressive than it is, because I most an awful lot of that time, 50 years, I was less mindful than I was mindful. But the longer I do this practice, the more I realize how simple it is, and that's a great gift. So I'm hoping to try to put that into words as best I can this morning. Our busy minds tend to complicate things. That's our experience. You probably had that experience in your meditation this morning. The busy mind tends to complicate things. We lean in, we problem solve, we strive to make something happen. We try to cultivate happiness, we try to get rid of hindrances or unhappiness. And the one thing that we don't do until we kind of learn the practice is simply relax and settle into whatever's going on in the moment. So the practice is a lot easier than we make it out to be. Tlopa, who was the teacher of Naropa, and Naropa was the founder of the Vajrayana tradition in Tibet. In northern India, actually. So this all happened 1,000 years ago. Tlopa was Naropa's teacher. And Tlopa had 6 words of advice, basically 6 practice instructions that he offered Naropa. And they're worth remembering because they're equally applicable today. Don't recall. Another way of saying that is let go of what has passed. Don't imagine. Let go of what may come. Don't think. Let go of what's happening now. Don't examine. Don't try to figure anything out. Don't control. Don't try to make anything happen. And rest. Relax right now. And rest. So that's a lot more than 6 words, but my understanding is in archaic Sanskrit, it was actually just 6 words. Don't recall, don't imagine, don't think, don't examine, don't control, and relax. Rest. The first 5 instructions are stated as negatives, that is to don't do. Final instruction, relax, is a positive instruction, something to do. But it's a bit ironic that the thing that we're encouraged to do is to not do. So for most of us, meditation feels like a whole lot of doing. If only it's a whole lot of letting go. Letting go of dwelling in the past, of anticipating the future. Letting go of getting attached to whatever thoughts are arising in the present moment. This can seem like an overwhelming task, but really it's just about paying attention. When that feels unmanageable, we are reminded that we can simply relax, the last instruction, relax in the present moment. No need to make the mind an enemy when it could be your anchor and refuge. The mind is not a thing. It's basically 2 processes. The mind is emptiness and cognition. When we meditate, we're well aware of cognition. And that's what we notice. We notice that the clutter of thinking, of thoughts and memories and images and stories and things popping up in our consciousness, that's all cognition. It's very demanding. It demands our attention when we're meditating. Sometimes we think that's all there is. So that can feel kind of overwhelming. It can feel totally out of control, actually. Bhante Gunaratana has a wonderful quote about that you may have heard. Somewhere in this process, you will come face to face with the sudden and shocking realization that you are completely crazy. Your mind is a shrieking, gibbering madhouse on wheels, barreling pell-mell down the hill, utterly out of control and hopeless. But no problem. You're not any crazier than you were yesterday. It's always been this way. You just never noticed before. So it's this out-of-control feeling that feeds fear and anxiety. It's just a perception. It gets its belief, it gets its power from the belief we have that that's not supposed to be happening. We get all caught up in the cognitive workings of the mind, which cover over its fundamental nature. To use the Garden of Eden metaphor, which I've been reflecting a lot lately, by eating from the tree of knowledge, we've lost paradise. Here's what the Buddha said about the fundamental nature of the mind. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, but it is colored by the attachments that visit it. This, unlearned people do not really understand, and so do not cultivate the mind. Luminous is this mind, brightly shining, and it is free of the attachments that visit it. This, the noble follower of the way, really understands, so for them, there's cultivation of the mind. From my own experience, the nature of the mind cannot be accessed from a book or a Dharma talk. The empty nature of the mind won't be revealed by thinking about it. It's only available through your own direct experience of the present moment. Munindraji said, if you want to understand your mind, sit down and observe it. Meditation is about mindfully letting go of those cognitive addictions, and they are addictions. The addiction metaphor is very relevant to this practice. And starting to recognize the luminous qualities of the mind. It's already there. It's not something that we need to crave. We simply need to let go and relax and recognize the empty qualities of mind. And just once again, the mind is not a thing. It's more an absence of things. Sometimes it's just a space between thoughts. There is space between thoughts that you can notice. And once you recognize that space between thoughts, it can be expanded. And that's emptiness, which is sometimes a weighty concept in the Dharma world. In the Tibetan tradition, emptiness is a whole existential, philosophical way of viewing the world. Quite deep and weighty. But emptiness is really quite simple. If you look around this room, or just look straight ahead, as you already are, what do you see, the features of this room? You see probably a brick wall behind me, and a Buddha Rupa, and backs of people's heads, maybe, colors. But mostly, what makes up this room, the space, is space. The space between things, the space between our bodies, the space between your eyes and the wall. And if you can project your imagination just outside of these thin walls, there's even more space outside. The sky. And then project your imagination even farther into outer space. Space. It's mostly space. The Buddha said space and emptiness is a skillful reflection. Because the space in this room, the space in outer space, is reflective, or a metaphor. Maybe it's not a metaphor because it's exactly the same thing for the space in our mind. The mind is spacious. But just like when we look around this room and we're not particularly mindful, we see the stuff. We only see stuff. We don't see space. Likewise, when we sit down and look at our mind, we see the thoughts and the memories and the feelings and the bodily sensations. We see the stuff that arises. So noticing spaciousness is takes some training. Simply letting go. Most of us Westerners, an awful lot of Westerners, find this hard to accept. That's why there aren't a whole lot of Buddhists in the world. If something is not complex and rational, if it doesn't arise from thinking, we don't trust it. We don't have much faith in simplicity. Mindfulness and awareness are just not complicated enough for us. We can't wrap our minds around them. The Tibetan teacher Kalu Rinpoche listed the four faults of awareness. And the four faults of awareness are essentially the problems that people have with awareness. It's a little bit tongue-in-cheek, but they're wonderful. So this is the problem of awareness. It's so close, you can't see it. It's so deep, you can't fathom it. It's so simple, you can't believe it. It's so good, you can't accept it. This lack of trust and awareness puts a lot of people off Buddhism altogether, or maybe just off meditation. They trust their thinking mind, but not their intuition. Mindfulness just seems too simple, as I said. Even practitioners, regular practitioners, often favor Dharma talks and books over their own direct experience. They can't see that there's a more profound wisdom in their own experience than they can find in books and talks. There's a saying in the Dharma world that listening to Dharma talks like this without practicing is like endlessly perusing a menu without ever tasting the food. Wisdom does not arise from thinking. Or as Thich Nhat Hanh says, understanding does not arise as the result of thinking. It is a result of a long process of conscious awareness. Sometimes understanding can be translated into thoughts, but thoughts are too limited to carry very much understanding. So, if cognitive understanding is not the source of wisdom, what is? The Buddha said, agreeing with Thich Nhat Hanh, or perhaps Thich Nhat Hanh said, agreeing with the Buddha, the wisdom, or the awareness, is a more reliable place to find wisdom. Utejaniya, the Burmese teacher, says, if awareness is present, wisdom is present. Simple as that. So how do we cultivate awareness? We meditate. We practice. The invitation is to simply relax and pay attention. Pay attention to what is going on in our direct experience in this present moment. This is reality, and this is the only reality from a phenomenological point of view. And furthermore, we only can experience that reality. We can only experience reality through our six sense doors. Reality, from the Buddhist point of view, reality is seeing, hearing, feeling, smelling, tasting, and cognizing in the present moment. Reality, as I said, only happens in the present moment. When a sense door makes contact with a sense object, like the ear receiving a sound. That's contact, moment of contact. The sense door is the ear. The sound is the sense object, or the body, receiving, having a sensation. It's the sense door of feeling, receiving a sensation. We're familiar with the first five sense doors: seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, and feeling, which is physical sensation. But one of the unique insights and profound insights of the Buddha that was truly unique to him was that there was a sixth sense door, and that's the sense door of the mind. And the mind's objects are thoughts and feelings. This insight leads us to understand the mind in a different way. It actually, I find, deflates the power of the mind, or the power that we imagine that the mind has over us. If we see the mind as just another sense door, and its objects no more threatening, then its objects are no more threatening than the sounds we hear or the sensations that we feel. Thoughts are just as impermanent and changeable. Thoughts and feelings arise of their own volition and pass away in exactly the same way as the objects of all the other sense doors, if we allow them. So check this out in your own experience. As Adyashanti says, it's not what you think. It's much, much less. So I'm making a distinction between thoughts and thinking here. So for the purpose of this talk, thoughts are those thoughts, images, stories, feelings that arise and pass in your mind of their own volition. You know, thoughts you don't invite, they just come up. Same thing happens in dreams. You just get these bizarre images and collections of images and trails of thoughts that just, you know, make no sense. They just come out of nowhere. We do that in daily life, too. Those are thoughts. Nothing to worry about. That's what the mind does. They don't, and you can't wipe them out. They sometimes get very still in meditation, but you can't stop that process. But they're conditioned phenomena, and not mere mind. Thinking, on the other hand, is what happens when we get attached to thoughts. And we do that quite regularly. Some thought jumps, it pops into our head, and it's juicy. It's either something that we really want to chase and follow and feed, or we're aversive to it. Something really nasty. You know, it's, we don't like it, but we're drawn to it because it has power. Just conditioned phenomena. So thoughts are not an enemy. It's the attachment that's a problem. This is the source of suffering. Attachment. The source of suffering is the second noble truth. Another Burmese teacher, Sayadaw Unpagita, says, when the mind indulges in distractions, it becomes agitated. This is the usual state of affairs in the world, as we can observe. In their quest for happiness, people mistake excitement in the mind for real happiness. They never have a chance to experience the greater joy that comes from peace and tranquility. I love that quote, and sometimes I think of it when I see all the people walking down the street looking at their phones while they're walking down the street. In their quest for happiness, people mistake excitement of the mind for real happiness. They need to excite their minds. They need a distraction. Something needs to be going on. That's just human nature. That's what we do. So getting back to Tilopa's six words, our job in meditation is to let go of these attachments and trust the naturally empty quality of the mind. When things are quiet, we don't have to fill up that space. We have options. we can learn to appreciate the spaces between thoughts more than the thoughts themselves. This takes some practice, because it's not our usual habit of mind. From a neurological perspective, we're carving new neural pathways. That's what the practice does. Neural pathways supporting peace and tranquility. I like to, in my beginning meditation classes, I like to compare meditation to playing scales on the piano. And sometimes just as routine and boring as that. So if you want to learn how to play Chopin, you have to learn how to play scales on the piano first. You have to train the fingers to move in a certain way. You have to train the mind to coordinate with the fingers, and playing scales is the way you do that. And it might be boring, it might be mind-numbing when you first start out, as meditation practice sometimes feels. But in the end, you'll be playing beautiful music. In meditation, this involves relaxing and opening up to whatever is being experienced in the moment without trying to control it. Don't recall, don't imagine, don't think, don't examine, don't control. And if you find yourself caught up in these activities, gently relax and let go. Just ground yourself in the present and start again. The instructions couldn't be more simple. Just relax and pay attention. That's all you need to know. The Thai teacher, mid-20th century great Thai teacher, who founded my tradition of meditation, Ajahn Chah, said, "If you let go a little, you'll have a little peace. If you let go a lot, you'll have a lot of peace. If you let go completely, you will have complete peace. And your struggles with the world will have come to an end." I was watching a documentary, which I've watched twice now. I was rewatching a documentary the other night called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And I highly recommend it. It's about a Japanese national treasure named Jiro Ono. And he's a sushi chef. And he has this tiny little sushi restaurant that has become very, very famous because he's a perfectionist and he makes just the best sushi, which is why he's been made a Japanese national treasure. And so there's a wonderful documentary about him that includes a lot of interviews with him called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And in the documentary, Jiro says, "You must dedicate your life to mastering your skill. That is the key to happiness." So I find that true for Dharma practice as well. With practice, this will become a new habit of mind. You'll be more relaxed, more open and happy, because a peaceful mind is a happy mind. And this practice will, at least in my experience, spill over into everyday life. And here's another thing that happens. In the eyes of the conventional world and your non-practicing friends, you will become a more boring person. Because the less you think, and you might have noticed this from Dharma practitioners, the less you think, the less you have to say about things. But it's not a problem. The meditation teacher, South Bay meditation teacher, Gil Fronsdahl, who I'm very fond of, likes to say, if it's not boring, it's not Buddhist. Abiding in a quiet mind is far preferable to the frantic multitasking that we're used to indulging in, isn't it? Nyingyur Rinpoche says, "The insight that the Buddha discovered is so simple and yet so difficult to accept. His teachings introduce us to a dormant, hidden, unrealized part of ourselves. This is the great paradox of the Buddhist path, that we practice in order to know what we already are, and therefore attaining nothing, getting nothing, going nowhere. We seek to uncover what has already been here all along. So I hope this talk has not given you food for thought. Rather, I hope that you'll be inclined to set aside concepts of emptiness, like emptiness and nature of mind, and simply sit quietly, observing whatever is going on in the present moment. And if a busy mind is what's going on, simply notice that and accept it. It's like this. And like all conditioned phenomena, it will change. So let's just take a moment and sit. You don't have to adopt a special posture. You might close your eyes and let your gaze turn inward and just notice what's going on. Hearing, feeling, perhaps tasting, smelling, sense of touch, and cognizing. Thank you for your kind attention. So in my frequent state of confusion, I sometimes do better with questions and answers than I do with Dharma talks. I prefer this part. Well, you know, one thing I didn't mention is that in Sangha, I find this useful to notice that there's kind of three different wisdom mechanisms going on when we come to Sangha. There's the meditation, the silent meditation, which we're accessing our own wisdom, intuition. There's the Dharma talk, where some teacher sits up here and spouts information. And then there's the discussion, whether it's discussion between ourselves or Q&A at the end. And they're all different ways of accessing the Dharma and accessing wisdom. And I just find it useful to kind of notice the impact of those different ways of learning, of being. And really useful to notice which one you prefer. There's not a right answer to that. Some people like meditation better than Dharma talk, and some people are just the other way around. But anyway, this is Q&A and discussion, so welcome your questions or feedback or anything I might have. Please.
So, thank you. I think your talk was wonderful, and it certainly is all the things that I most need to learn and that I have the most difficulty with. But my which is, you know, always there, comes to another issue. So we were also instructed to follow the middle way and to deal with kindness and compassion, among other things, as well as I think where this is focused and what I particularly need, which is, if not happiness and contentment or equal poise or equanimity, whatever surgical term one wants. And in doing that, it seems to me that that also requires thinking. So kindness, for example, how did I say this to you with kindness rather than argumentatively, and it arises in the world And so this is the piece of Buddhism which my mind persists in being puzzled by. On the one hand, it says to come to equanimity, and on the other hand, it says to be concerned about suffering, yours and others, which seems to me to partially require thinking, and I wondered if you had any further comment around this.
Well, it certainly does. That's very true. The Eightfold Path, the Buddhist Eightfold Path, kind of falls into three general sections. And one is virtue, including compassion and generosity and how we are in the world. The second is wisdom group, and the third is the meditation group. So what I was mostly talking about this morning was wisdom and meditation. But they all fold in together. And yes, we need to think just to get by in the world. We need to think, you know, you needed to do a certain amount of thinking to get dressed this morning and get yourself to Sangha. So I'm not saying you can do without thinking, but it's really, really nice to be able to take a break from it every once in a while. You know, if we spend 98% of our day thinking, that 2% of the time that we're not thinking is a wonderful gift. Mm-hmm. So that's what I have been, that's what I emphasize.
Okay. And it's very important to wise thinking, because as Buddha also said, the happy person or the...
Which is a step on the Eightfold Path.
...more harmed another.
Yeah, wise thinking, absolutely. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So is that helpful?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thinking's okay. Jeffrey.
Well, thank you for a wonderful talk. It's good to see you, David. Joseph Goldstein said all paths lead to zero or one. And it struck me today you're talking about zero. Nothing, nobody, nowhere. And Ramdas talked about it, had a movie called Becoming Nobody Special. And yet when we become nobody, and the thoughts stop in that space where there's still awareness, right?
I mean, absolutely. This could turn into a really big discussion. So let me see if I can summarize it. And people would debate with me on this, but awareness is not the same as consciousness. Consciousness requires an object. So, for instance, if the ear hears a sound, there's consciousness. There's ears, consciousness of sound. Yeah. So consciousness is conditioned. Mm-hmm. It comes and goes. It arises and disappears like all other conditioned things. Consciousness is conditioned. But awareness is always there.
Yeah.
No matter what's going on, awareness is all that. So that's the difference. The way I define it, that's the difference between awareness and consciousness.
Yeah,
and all those teachers are basically saying that, as I understand.
Yeah, awareness is the substrate, right?
Yeah, and it's always there in the background. It's something that's just waiting to be tapped into.
Yeah.
Just like... It just only requires that same shift of mind that you make when you notice the space in this room instead of the stuff in this room. It's just a little shift of perspective.
Yeah.
It doesn't take a lot of learning. It just
it's removal or the absence of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Space between thoughts.
Yeah. Thank you.
It's beautiful. It makes me happy. Thank you. Thank you for that question. Yes, please.
I'm curious how, thank you for your talk, and very thoughtful. It is unfortunately thought-provoking. I'm wondering where emotion fits into it. You included it as just sort of part of the mind, and but it seems like it's sort of always there. It's not necessarily a facet of consciousness, is that right? Nothing is necessarily, I mean, it's not being triggered necessarily by something in the moment. It's something that kind of resides in a semi-permanent state. So is wisdom, by wisdom, do we leave, try to get beyond emotion?
No. No. It's such a great question. No, emotion's quite natural. And in the technically, in the Buddhist perspective, emotion is part of cognition. So it's really, if you think about it, and you check this out in your own experience, it's hard to separate thoughts from emotions. Because sometimes, and getting back to something you said, emotions are conditioned, so they are triggered by something. So often a thought will trigger emotion. We'll read something disturbing in the paper and we'll get upset. But it's equally true that sometimes just an emotion comes out of nowhere. You wake up on the wrong side of the bed and everything you see annoys you for the rest of the day. So emotion impacts thoughts as well. So emotions and thoughts are like that. They're really hard to separate out. But they are, it's all conditioned. So, you know, even waking up on the wrong side of the bed, there's something that triggered that. Mm-hmm. It might have been something that happened yesterday or a bad dream or you...
Being hungry.
You're hungry. Yeah. So, yeah, emotion is very human and very natural, just like thinking. There's nothing wrong with it. The thing that we want to... develop is mindfulness of emotion so that we see it happening when it's happening. And sometimes when we see it happening when it's happening, we become less identified with it. We just think, oh, I woke up on the wrong side of the bed today and I'm just cranky. This is a cranky day. It doesn't mean you're a cranky person. You're just, you know, for these couple of hours you're cranky. But that's not fundamentally you. That's just passing phenomena. So that's where mindfulness really helps with both emotion and thinking, is just being aware that that's going on. Yeah, helpful.
Yeah, thank you.
Anybody else? Anybody?
David?
Yes.
This is Tom Cantwell in Portland.
Oh, hi, Tom. Good to hear you.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. I can't really see you, but I can hear you.
When I found out you were the speaker, my heart got big. And so it's really good to hear you again, and I wish I could continue on with the Thursday meetings. Unfortunately, work right now is, demanding I not. One question I have is about, where does anxiety fall into the emotional spectrum, or is it an emotion?
Good question, and thanks for saying hi. I'm so good to see you. It's been a while. That's a good question. Anxiety, well, I'm not a therapist or a psychologist, so I'm not an authority. But from my own experience, anxiety is a combination of thoughts and feelings. And we might have a feeling such as fear or trepidation, and you might notice that triggers thoughts about, oh, you know, what if this happens, or what if that happens, or, you know, if I have a skin cancer and I get a diagnosis, then, you know, that's going to trigger anxiety and fear. So it's a combination, for me, it's a combination of anxiety, fear, of thoughts and feelings. But from a mindfulness perspective, what makes it anxiety is we just keep feeding it. And that's the way to deal with it mindfully, is to notice how we keep feeding it, how we keep coming back to the same fears, the same idea, the same obsessions. And we all have them about something. But if we can stop that cycle of coming back over and over and over again to the same anxiety, anxious thoughts, then anxiety can dissipate some.
Thank you.
Sure.
I found sometimes if I think of it, getting into my body, into my breath, out of my head is really helpful. Again, no thought.
Yeah, well, well said. And I often say, probably oversimplifying, if you want to get out of your head, get into your body. So if you're feeling anxious, go for a walk.
Right.
I think that is about all the time we have
okay.
today. So I'd like to call now for announcements. Do we have any announcements?
We have a host today, which is me. Please stay and enjoy the company of the Sangha. There are tangerines, walnut cookies, and some curious tarts from a friend born from the Philippines. So if you enjoy. If you have tea, just please put your cup in the sink and I'll deal with it from there. I'll be going around with the donor bowl to accept the contributions. Suggested donation is between $10 and $20. And we use that for honorariums for our speakers, rent for the center, and our quarterly newsletter, which is mostly mailed to people in prison. There's a sign-up sheet on the credenza here if you'd like to get be on our mailing list. And some people go out to lunch, meet Badu around 12:30. And if that's your intention, you might consider inviting someone to join you. So please stay and enjoy the fellowship of the Sangha.
Are there any other announcements?
Yes. Could I say that we could use some volunteers to help with the Zoom setup? We're going to be shorthanded over the summer, and could we use some new people to just do a little bit of work before the meeting and after the meeting, setting up the Zoom mechanics or techniques.
And thank you, Marcus, who stepped up and became a new Zoom fellow. If you have questions, just ask Marcus. There's a paper guide and a video guide on how to do it, so consider it.
And thank you, Henry.
Thank you. David. I'd like to tell you about next week. Three members of our Sangha, Jeff Lindemood, Michael Murphy, and Cass Brayton, recently participated in a month-long meditation retreat in Bali, Indonesia. Next week, they will speak about how they structured their daily schedule and prepare Dharma talks on their self-guided retreat. They will share photos from the unique retreat villa near Ubud, Bali, and talk about insights gained and lessons learned from the retreat. So, David has agreed to lead us in the dedication of merit. So let's do that now.
Well, just a reminder that the merit of our practice carries forth beyond ourselves. Many of us are here because we either want to be happy or we want to suffer less in the world. And in the very same way that that's true for us, that's something we wish for all those we love and all beings that we know and we don't know. May all beings be safe and protected from danger and harm. May all beings everywhere be healthy in body and mind. May they live with peace and ease. May all beings be free of suffering. May it be so.
Thank you for listening to the Gay Buddhist Forum. If you would like to hear several new talks per month and be notified of upcoming speakers so you can participate live, please subscribe to this podcast, like us on Facebook, and join our mailing list by visiting gaybuddhist.org.